All right, here we are, part two, lecture four. We finally got to Henri Bortoft, although I think I put this reading up probably more than 2 weeks ago. It looks like we're finally getting into what I would consider to be the beginning of the course on language proper, if you like, on philosophy of language, because McGilchrist and Maturana and Verdun Zola aren't philosophers. They're more looking at the origins of language from a perspective of brain science and the perspective of evolution. But I thought it was worthwhile looking into that background before we actually look into a more kind of focused attention on language as we have it before us now. So we're not looking now into the past of language. We're looking into how we understand language and meaning in our contemporary lives. And this particular chapter from Bortoff is looking at what meaning is, and particularly the meaning of a text, of a written text. So he's taking that as his example, because a lot of work's been done on this, especially a lot of contemporary work in contemporary philosophy, which I'm not an expert on. I should mention that. So I don't know if any of you have done any other courses on contemporary French philosophy, postmodernism, that sort of area, where literary criticism, where there's a lot of attention paid to the meaning of texts. So I'm aware that what Bortoff's talking about relates to this work. He particularly likes Deleuze, who is one of those philosophers. I always feel like when I'm on tape, I present, I judge a philosopher. I feel like maybe I should turn the tape off, but he's someone I can't read. That a lot of the contemporary, late 20th century French philosophers, I just can't read them, and because I'm not I'm not a professional philosopher. I find if I can't read you, then I don't read you. I only read the philosophers I can read. But I suspect, at the same time, that there is some. I don't want to just dismiss the people I can't read. I just say I can't read them. So I respect Bortoff, and Bortoff finds things of value in Deleuze, and I know that some of the concepts we've got here have come from Deleuze. Especially the idea of distinction and difference. But so we'll just bear that in mind. But at the background here, we're talking about hermeneutics, which is that a term that anyone was familiar with already?
I read a term, John D. Caput, he's like a weak theologian. I read his book recently on facts of the age of interpretation, hermeneutics.
Yes. Yes.
Which sort of went in towards religion, towards the end. And it's sort of applied to go to read for a walk.
Yes. Yes, so there's a whole tradition here of 20th century philosophy that's been very influential in the world of philosophy, but I'm not sure it got out into the mainstream. But all philosophy kind of gets out in the mainstream by almost through the right brain, through indirect influence. A lot of postmodernist thought has crept into our world in the form of a certain kind of relativism, which is a kind of an idea that nobody should impose some kind of patriarchal fixed meaning on anything. And that's a gross simplification of things. And at the back of hermeneutics, which is a term I think in modern terms you trace back to Heidegger, but if you take it back further, it related to I forget his name now. It begins with S. It's German and it's a long name. It was to do with the interpretation of the Bible, of holy texts, trying to work out the meaning of scripture. which involves what we come to think of as interpretation. But the idea of hermeneutics there was certain difficult texts needed interpreting, whereas more modern texts are sort of transparent and have their own meaning. You just read them and you get the meaning from the text directly. Whereas when Heidegger started to look into hermeneutics, he started coming to the idea that we interpret everything. There isn't really such a thing as an uninterpreted experience. So do you see hermeneutics from being a kind of a method for trying to work out the meaning of an obscure text became a kind of an understanding about not just understanding particular texts or all texts, but that our entire experience is an interpretation of, and I feel like saying dot, dot, dot. That will that. An interpretation of the unnameable, inexpressible source of experience. I guess the idea, something at the core, the heart of hermeneutics is this, it's saying in a way that it's not a terrible thing that everything that we experience in some sense is interpreted. What it's saying is it's because what lies behind that is just unknowable. The idea of an interpretation sort of implies that it's an interpretation of something that you could know. That behind the interpretation is the real reality. Whereas I think the deeper insight in hermeneutics is that I picture it something like this. The true being of what is, if you like, in order to be known, has to be transposed into an experience. What is in itself is not an experience. If you think of all that is just one unity of being, and this is an imagination, right? This is just to illustrate the point. That unity of being would know itself absolutely, but it would be nothing. Do you see that? Because it would be all that is, all at once, all together, being itself. There's nothing to know, right? In order to know something, in some sense, there has to be a something over here that's looking at something over there. Yes. And if you're over here looking at something over there, then you're no longer the unity of what actually is. You're kind of seeing it in a certain way. Yes. The only way that being can know itself is by seeing itself, and in seeing itself, it's no longer exactly being itself. These are all quite abstract ideas, but there's a certain kind of illusion that we have that what we experience is it's very hard to put this into language, because it's not. There's, at the other end of it, you've got a kind of a thing that says, "Oh, we just it's all Maya. It's an illusion. What we experience is a kind of a picture," and that you get in a problem which we're going to get into in the lecture, where you could say, "Well, if all I'm experiencing is a kind of a picture of what is, then how do I know that the picture's real or true?" These are, you know, if you do philosophy, especially first year philosophy, these are the sort of questions that typically you're asked in a philosophy degree. Have you ever really stopped to consider the nature of reality? You know, is there obviously what you're experiencing is something going on in your brain, and what's going on in your brain clearly isn't the same as what's going on out here, and what's going in your brain, not only that, you're not experiencing that, you're experiencing something in this thing called consciousness that sort of represents what's going on in your brain, that sort of represents what's going on out there. How can you know that what you're experiencing in consciousness is actually what's going on out there? You know, these are philosophical puzzles that people enjoy thinking about. But often at the back of that philosophical puzzle, there's some kind of idea that says, but what's going on out here is what physics tells us is going on. Whereas, in a way, what hermeneutics says is, well, what's going on out there isn't anything you could ever possibly experience. It's not experientiable. It's the very source out of which experience emerges. Husserl and Fink went as far as to say, and it doesn't, it doesn't actually exist. Our experience exists, but the source of experience, in terms of our language, to say that it exists or it doesn't exist doesn't really mean anything, because the way that we use the word exists, when you say this cup exists, well, yes, we can agree what that means, but what about the unnameable, inexpressible, unknowable source out of which the experience of this, as the cup has come, does that exist? Well, no, stuff exists out here in experience, doesn't it? I know this is a rather circuitous introduction to hermeneutics, but I just start to throw you into the this sort of questioning of experience, because we're not going to go into that yet. I mean, I think Heidegger is going to help us get more into that direction. But what we start off, let's come back from that into what we would consider the common sense view of the meaning of a work. And I don't know if you've thought about this independently, because we're going to start to look into what sort of being does the meaning of a text or a piece of work have. And I think when I first started to think about this, I did have a common sense view of it, in the sense that if somebody writes something, then they had a sort of a meaning in them. Yeah, there's this kind of, there was a meaning there. I'm writing something right now. There's a meaning in me, and I'm writing it down on the page. And the words, if you like, are expressing a meaning in me, and they become a kind of a physical manifestation of something that was in my mind. And then I give you the what I've written. You read it, and in some way or other, if you like, the meaning's up there. You, by reading the words, you get to see the same thing as I was looking at. Something like, well, I'm wondering, how do you what do you think's going on with language?
Well, it's more from experience. We know that there is a Chinese whispering effect going on as well, isn't it? Because
when things are passed on. But
I mean, even like you write, I read.
Yeah.
But even the medium, already when you wrote, what the medium is captured in words is not exactly what you meant, and then when I hear it or read it, I'm already now two steps removed. So it's almost like there is a one more person in between us.
So you're putting in a sort of there's the meaning, and then there's me failing to put it into words properly.
No, it's
not
even failure.
Maybe that's the wrong word. But I didn't quite capture it.
Gurdjieff said something nice about it. He said, like, if somebody is playing the flute and he could make a snake charmer is playing the flute and he can make a snake dance, a talented enough artist could do it to a human. He could make the impression. He could really control the impression that his word or work of art will have on whoever sees it, as opposed to a normal artist which creates a piece of art, but really one person will take it this way, one person will take it that way, and the artist really doesn't, you know what he's doing well enough. So we can kind of do it to a snake, but we can't do it to a human.
Well,
unless we are high.
Or unless we...
But when you think about the snake, if you, by the virtue of playing music, make it dance or whatever, or perform something, what kind of impact you had with this art on the snake that made him dance? Can you think of that you could potentially generate something like that?
But let me give you a very simple example where I say, well, no, it's not that hard. Here I am, what I'm writing is I smash the salt cellar, you know, and I send the message to Nicolette, and that causes her to buy a new one. You know, there are certain levels where the meaning is, you know, a meaning can be quite literal, and that's like the snake dancing, you know. There are degrees here, aren't there?
Yes.
It's when it comes to a work of art, and of course he is, Bortov is thinking about a work of art here, but a work of art, it's not intended to be producing necessarily an effect in whoever's reading it. Not necessarily.
I think it would help. In terms of that interpretation, I think that just like there's an English, there's a, in respect about the BBC, there's enough of a collective body to understand, for you to understand what I'm saying now, and there's a communality of the language of what's been spoken. But I think with something that's written almost, is that if you want someone to judge what to appraise what has been written, to get their feedback, they've got to have a feeling about what's written on the page. So more than the salt cellar, I know that was just an example, but they've got a feel for the subject matter. I think it helps a bit, like with stage art.
But even with the salt shaker example, it's problematic, isn't it? Because you said I smashed the salt shaker, so it's the implication that it was you. But if I was to read it, not knowing that you had written it, I read it, I didn't smash the salt shaker.
Yeah.
Who smashed the salt shaker?
Yeah.
So if there was a computer there, so I couldn't even analyse your handwriting.
No, and not only that, I've sent it to Nicolette, and Nicolette, it would mean, if I sent you a message saying I smashed the salt shaker, you'd say, well, so what? What are you telling me for?
Mm.
You know, it's all in context.
And also, as well, it's not both the other person either, it's you can have inconsistencies within yourself. So you've got the written piece, I smashed the salt shaker, and you'd be satisfied, yes, that communicates exactly what I'm thinking, my internal meaning. You put it in a drawer, 3 months later, you find this piece of paper saying, I smashed a salt shaker. You're not entirely sure what the meaning of that is. You probably do remember that you smashed a salt shaker. But still, even though there's cues there for you to remember what the original meaning was, you being the person who wrote it, it's still a little bit inconsistent. It doesn't have the same meaning as it did the time you wrote it. So you
yes.
can have that sort of transaction and that interpretation error of someone else, because you can interpret it in the wrong way yourself.
Yes, I mean, you know how, finally, because you and I are computer programmers, we could start cleaning it up. We could say, at this exact time, on this exact day, at this exact year, at this exact physical location, I, my full name, dropped the salt cellar in this room, you know. We could narrow it down so that all of our words refer to an utterly unambiguous sequence of events, but of course we'd have to, finally, if it was a computer, we'd have to make sure that the computer understood what dropped meant, that I'm a human being, that I have hands, you know. But we could finally, probably, it would be a small novel, we could probably explicate exactly what we meant in that particular instance.
But it's boring.
Yeah. No, you, that's why a lot of people don't get into computer programming. Because in effect, that's what you know, if you're instructing a computer program to do something, you have to tell it exactly what to do, with no ambiguity in it whatsoever. And you see that you learn then how much our language assumes. When, you know, I drop the salt cellar assumes an awful lot. But it's still a kind of a meaning where if I get it across to Nicolette, there isn't really any leeway. Because she's got the context, I've got the context, it's the right day. On the right day in the right circumstances, we're not thinking there's a grey area there. But there's as we stretch out, there's the sort of an element there where you could say, yeah, there was a meaning in my mind and I got it into Nicolette's mind.
Yeah.
You know, because we share the same background and all of that's taken care of. And we're, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So because we're looking at this, there's a sense there where, yes, we've got meanings and we transfer them between minds. And Boltoff wants to say this is problematic.
But that's just assuming the meaning is always static and copied rather than the meaning. You can still convey what you want to say and people add to that, and so that meaning comes. But you still have the central meaning that you're conveying, but people add to that. Did you go to see the Oliver Ellison exhibition in London?
No.
It was really good, wasn't
it?
And he's all about, where is the art?
Mm.
The art is, it's not there, it's not in front of you, it's you're experiencing it, and there's lots of things that you're walking through, and that's where the art is happening. It's happening you interacting with that environment.
That's true.
That's really good. Who
was that?
Oliver Ellison? He's
Oliver. He's a phenomenologist.
Is he?
Instantly
forget what what the words mean, but he's amazing.
Oliver, what was the surname?
Ellison.
Yeah.
ELIASON. He's Icelandic Danish.
So what kind of, what was the art form of the name?
Well, what are they? He uses light a lot, and he uses sort of reflective surfaces, and he uses shapes, and there's sort of a tunnel thing with all the sort of mirrored surfaces in it, and a lot of light. If you look up on his Instagram, he puts a lot of things on there that he's made, and he's highlighting the environment. So there was a thing in London with the ice, the piece of ice vetoed. I didn't see that, I just saw it on the photo. He found within the remains of icebergs. I think it was the remains of ice that had fallen away to highlight global warming and climate change. He towed them to London, and he had them. He placed them in a square somewhere, and people could come in, and they were there, but they were not the. No, no. He had them like on the ground, so people could interact with them. There might have been something on the fourth plinth, but there was a bunch of them that people could touch and feel, and this ancient stuff, and it's there, but as you're touching it, it's melting, it's disappearing, it's not there, and, you know, stuff that, yeah, it's ancient, the middle of it, but it was gone within days, and he just does amazing, beautiful things. He's a really cool guy. About that is happening in you, so what are you experiencing? You're obviously getting his intent,
yes,
and you experience it, but you know, he calls all his things your name thing. Your always seems to be the first word because you're experiencing it, and that's unique what you're experiencing.
So, I mean, the question that Boltoff is asking is to do with a work of art, but particularly a text. And particularly where the meaning, or what the meaning is, or how does it exist, or what kind of being does it have, the meaning of a text, because it's a bit more permanent in a way. It's because when you've written a text, you've got a bunch of words, and they're not melting like ice. They're fixed. There's a fixed form of the structure of the words, and the common sense view is inclined to think that those words together have a meaning, right? That's what we're looking at. And I was giving you the example where, and you, in very simple cases, you could sort of, you can kind of indicate that something you say or an instruction you give or, you know, a sign on a wall does have a have an unambiguous meaning. But that still doesn't really answer the question of, but where or in what way does that meaning exist? And the typical answer is that it's although it's strange when you start to examine it, is that the meaning exists in your mind. And the idea of communication is to get that meaning to be reproduced in the mind of somebody else.
But can I just interrupt there?
Yes.
Does the very act, some of us might have had the experience of this, but I've had the experience of this where I pick up a book and I'm reading it and I'm interested in it, and I've had experiences not that long ago, recently, where I'm reading and I'm thinking, God, it's amazing that I can read, and that there's this text here that's communicating to me about something meaningful to me, and it may be a story, or it may be, I don't know, philosophy, or and it doesn't happen every time I do that, but it's certainly happened a number of times, probably in this last year, where I thought, and as a child, I loved reading. That was my really sort of solace, was like I read and read and read as a child. And I just, it's the action of the reading, and the fact, it's amazing.
The magic of it.
That you've got a book that you want to read, not some sort of the newspaper, and it's, oh God, you know. But you're reading something that you've chosen to read, and it can just be this an amazing thing that you're reading something.
Like,
and
if
you're reading,
you feel someone writing.
Yeah, and you feel connected to that.
Yeah.
That person who's writing it,
yeah.
As if they're an old friend, because what they're saying is from them, and it's going into you, like they're just an old friend. But at the same time, it's the action of being able. I think, oh my God, thank God, I could. Isn't it a wonderful thing I can read? Number one, and that I understand this language. And the way that the language is being put together is incredible. The way that it's been written, it might be, I don't know, a wonderful book of literature, or it might be an autobiography, I don't know, whatever I'm reading, but, you know.
The skill of a writer as well, sometimes.
Exactly.
Such
skill.
Economy of words.
Yeah.
And yet all of these images ping up from really often very little text. How is that different? What's going on
there? And
it's
not the same as that other person that's writing.
Yeah.
It's that individual, unique, amazing way of putting together those words that I'm able to read and understand, all in the way that, a bit like what Paul Tropp is talking about.
Well,
but it's more than just words, it's just an incredible.
Well, sometimes I think I need an interpretation, I think sometime.
Yeah, I get that,
right?
Yeah.
Whether it be a book, an author on another author explaining something, or actually the medium of a radio, some really good radio, or TV, and then you can spark that interest to look.
Put a hole in there and think,
Yeah.
I wanted to say that because it relates to this.
Huh?
Yes.
Well, I think it is going into the mind of the author, though.
Yeah.
Like that joy he has when he writes it.
It's all
you. You're entering into that state.
It's
magic.
It is magic. It is magic, and it's just more than just like reading the information about how to try and fix something.
Also, it's a shorthand, isn't it? There's a shorthand that it was quite. When I got time to edit from what the thing said.
Oh, that's done that.
It's a gift. Also, it doesn't. These are people that you don't know in real life.
Mm.
I mean, we access a certain space to go and get a book.
Yeah.
on a given what could be seen as being totally random. You're just in a place and you're just pulling a book, and then you go away with that information. It is quite remarkable in that sense.
It is.
It's
almost beyond.
Well, it's a craft, isn't it?
It's hard to articulate what I'm trying to say, almost. But
you admire the craft, the ability to put into words something that will evoke this feeling or experience or whatever.
Mm.
It's very, it is amazing. It is amazing because it can be so. I mean, you can admire good music, you can admire good painting, but the words are so intrinsic.
But just as we're doing now, that's part of the power of it, isn't it? It's because I for a little short while, I was part of the book club. Never been part of a book club before, unlike yourself, Nicolette. I wasn't.
No, I haven't been part of a book club.
I don't know, but what I mean is that, unlike you, I wasn't an avid reader when I was a child.
No,
yeah. So a lot. What I enjoyed was through direct experiences, going out, chasing a ball, running, whatever it was. Yeah, but I think what I experienced through is the connection, and it's the connection that you can have with the writer in terms of what's written down.
Yeah,
I totally get that. We want to know more about that. But I think it's also in like a class setting, although this isn't a class, an experience of being together. It's that communication of it, which is then you think, wow, that's more than you're going to get. There's an idea of getting the privileged access. Like, I get that with a book. It's a privileged access to something.
So, Bortoff was, I just jumped to slide 8. He is talking about what Nicolette was saying on page 101, if you've done the reading, because I've cut this down. Because he called it a miracle, actually. I cut the miracle bit out. But he says, a text is a doorway through which the past can come to life for us now. This coming to life is quite extraordinary. And we will all have experienced this in the instant before it becomes covered over with layers of familiarity and begins to seem ordinary again. And that's the moment Nicolette was just alluding to.
It's almost like the words are almost like a tree or a beautiful thing saying...
I think it's the recording of the state of consciousness that you're of, that magical state of imagination that you're in. You're going through the writing, through the words on the page, you're entering it in that space.
That's an incredible.
Yes. I mean, I got this with D.H. Lawrence when I first read him, and I felt transported back into his world, into before the First World War. You know, I felt I was with Lawrence, seeing the world through his eyes, you know, closer to him than most of the people I knew in my life. It's just an amazing thing, isn't it, that somebody's vision can be brought back like that.
Yeah.
It's just, it's such a gift. I mean, immensely. Just reading Lawrence, I can't describe it, but it made the whole historical present that I'm living in, I could see it from 1880. Do you know? And it looks an awfully lot different, you know, where we are now, when you look back, and something like an author can communicate to you how people were seeing things with more depth in the past, because we just think, oh yeah, we're the business, right? We obviously see things deeper and further than the people in the past, because we've evolved out of that, right? And suddenly, you know, authors, Tolstoy as well, you know, communicate back. No, you know, you're living on the surface here.
When you get that freshness of someone that's written something a really long time ago, and it's as though. It's now. You read it.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
have to keep catching your head on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
This is that long ago because it's so fresh and immediate. And
it does something with time.
You know, when you get bad, blurry authors where there's layers of pomposity, but when it's that immediate,
it's like you're meeting beyond death.
Yeah.
You know the person's died, and yet they're in some way or other, through the work, they're still here, and you're able to. I mean, it is.
Challenges all the ideas that, like you say, that you have about the past, because you just sort of, they just sort of silt up in your head about the way the 1800s was, or the 20s, or the 30s. It's all cartoony, and then when you read someone who's written them, and it's really good, just all of that dust gets blown off.
Yeah. But we are coming back to the common sense view, because in fact we've left the common sense view well behind, and I'd like you to be commonsensical for a little while, so that we can embrace that view and before we get rid of it in a way. Do you know that? But this idea that we're trying to grasp the meaning that was in the author's mind when we read a text, and that I think he's not just making that up. I think if we did interviews, you know, a lot of people would agree with that point of view, and he wants to point out that there's problems with this, and one of the problems is that when he says it epistemologizes hermeneutics, he means it takes us back to the same problem that we get with perception. If our perception is a representation of a reality that's beyond us, how can we know that our perception is a true perception of the way that reality is? Answer, philosophically, we can't. And this is, and a lot of as he says in the book, a lot of ink has been expended on this. You know, how do we know that we're not experiencing some sort of an illusion? That, you know, the classic thing is the brain in the vat. How do we know that there isn't a mad scientist, and our brain's in a vat, and they're just feeding signals to our brain to make us experience this room? How do we know that's not the case? Or it was the Matrix, the movie, was the movie of that idea, if you've seen the Matrix. So we've got a similar thing going on once you embrace this idea that the author has a meaning in mind, and your job as a reader is to reconnect with that meaning. How can you ever know that you've got the meaning that the author had in mind? I mean, possibly by going to visit the author and having an extremely long conversation, you might just get to that. But even then, you know, you can already see the problem that I think you were portraying. Yes, but even then, that was 3 weeks after the author wrote it. You know, all you're meeting with then is what the author thinks the meaning is now. The author can't even be sure that that was the meaning that he or she had in the actual writing of the piece.
Because they're in a different state of mind.
Yeah. Thinking. Oh, gosh. I mean, I'm writing at the moment, and it's... I'm in a funny place with it. I just can't remember what I'm writing. I have to pick it up again every time and read. I'm writing a particular chapter. I have to start from the beginning again. So, oh, I said that, did I? You know, it's like, I don't know what's going on there.
You're
channeling. Not at the time I'm not, though. It doesn't feel like, it feels like I'm looking and I'm going, what should I write next? It's just not getting recorded somewhere. So if you were to ask me what I meant, I would definitely be like that author. 3 weeks down the line, I'd be reading it afresh like you. You know, so it's no, I can't help you any more than, yeah, you know, I can.
I have no control over what people, you know, like how authors get really annoyed when their books get adapted not in a way that makes them happy.
Yes.
And, you know, so somebody's read the text and thought, it's like this. And so you've got no control really over how people can interpret it.
Well, we're going to get to that. In fact, if I don't think it's today, but really somewhere at the middle of this discussion, there is a deeper question about this. It's going to recur. How do you know that you really have grasped the true meaning? Or is there a true meaning?
Does it matter?
Does it matter? These are the...
fiction tries to do that in comparison with fiction.
Yes.
Or fiction is just the meaning, it just completely changes all of these. Well, I guess non-fiction, is it tried to obviously have a solid...
That's the idea.
But is that not true?
Well, no, non-fiction attempts to use language more in a more denotative way to point to actual events that occurred, but you can't escape it. I mean, you could say that a biography of somebody is non-fiction, but that's going to be full of interpretation, isn't it? Non-fiction is an extremely broad spectrum as well.
Is it not so clear-cut?
It's not clear-cut. I mean, at a certain point, you'd say a scientific paper is an example of something that's trying to be absolutely unambiguous. And after that, everything's got a degree of ambiguity in it, where you could say the meaning is negotiable. Okay, is that? But this is the question the lecture's asking: is meaning just negotiable? Is it just whatever you and each one of us has our own, takes our own little meaning home, and they're each as valid as each other.
You started talking about 20th century philosophy or French philosophy and all this bit. I think everything has got a context, so perhaps if it's got a historical, geographical, whatever. I think that bit, in terms of the meaning, people can collectively be more sure about, possibly, and then think that they can interpret the meaning of the author. Because we might not...
Because that is hermeneutics, right? That somebody classically engaged in hermeneutics actually attempts to go back into the historical situation of the person who was writing and sort of re-inhabit or reconstruct the mind of the author and then see what the meaning was from there and then somehow bring the meaning up into the present and interpret it for you. Yes? But we've still got the model being there's this meaning and we have to get it and... For the people back then, they didn't need me to interpret it because they had the background, yes? But we're saying, no, even within the same background, especially for a work of art, fiction's maybe the wrong word, you know, because you wouldn't say, a poem is a work of fiction, because I think a lot of people who are writing, and they'd say that I'm writing literature, they would be saying, well, no, I'm trying to express truth here in a way that non-fiction could never do. I'm trying to show you something that's true at a deeper level than the mere events.
Or give you the experience of something.
Yes.
As I mentioned earlier about the Job, and losing this meaning, or it's more than the sea when it has to be explained. It's that the poetry is trying to capture that.
Yes.
Could you say that again? I didn't kind of get that. Space.
No, about the joke.
The joke, a joke loses its potency when it has to be explained. You know,
okay.
So let's carry on. Yeah, we're getting to this. Different readers can understand one and the same text differently. Agreed, right? Definitely. So if the meaning of the text is what the author intended, then clearly only one or none of these readers understands the text correctly. How do we know which one has the correct meaning? And again, you know, yeah, I guess in this model, the only answer is to go back to the author, and then I can throw it back to you again. Well, the author's not the person who wrote the, you know, time's moved on.
Even the idea about a correct reading is problematic, isn't it?
The author might not have much self-knowledge, so he might actually be expressing some things, some opinions of his own, about, you know, the way
you're reminding me of Heidegger. Heidegger's, you know, a lot of philosophers are like this. When they write about another philosopher, they're writing in this way that says they didn't really understand what they were saying, but I do. Yes. Do you know there's a point where an interpretation goes can quite legitimately go beyond what the author thought they were saying. You know, you can read hidden intentions in what someone was writing that they weren't aware of, that illuminates the work, or that they've often in philosophy, I'm thinking of Heidegger on Kant, he says he sort of sees that Kant was seeing something but not clearly enough.
Mm.
Do you know that, like, so Heidegger comes along, I can see what he's seeing, but even more clearly. So let me explain it to you, because Kant wasn't able to get it, wasn't able to put it clearly like I can. And often interpretation in philosophy is like that. But then, do you see what I mean? We're often a very difficult sea here. You know, my interpretations, I'm so, you know, perceptive that I see things more clearly than the author. I guess Heidegger's response would be, well, if Kant was here, he'd agree with me. And so, yeah.
That's a bit like,
yeah,
you know, the amount of ways that Christianity's been manipulated, isn't it? Mm. Nobody's there to say, you've got it all wrong. It says thou shalt not kill, and all the rest.
Yeah, well, we've always got the Old Testament to throw to. Well, that comes from the Old Testament,
yes,
doesn't
it? Does, yeah.
We've got God's own actions. That was the problem there, wasn't it? There's always some leeway for a lawyer, isn't there?
But the New Testament was
I was going to say, like, you said a philosopher comes along and points on, but isn't that the whole point, really? That, like, this person's carrying on what the philosopher maybe would have done if he lived the whole other lifetime.
Yes.
So isn't that just the point of the arc of passing down?
It is. No, it is. I mean, that's definitely how Heidegger and Husserl regard if there's any sense that philosophy is a progression, then the work of a former philosopher will come to being something new in the light of what followed.
Mm,
yeah. There are consequences to what one philosopher says that just can't be explored in one lifetime. And not just that, but time and experience and events changes things. And I think this is what this is saying. This question about which one, if any, is the true understanding, and what do we do about the others? Are they all rubbish? You know, or is there of some value in the ones that weren't true understandings? Not that we know which ones aren't and which ones are, but if we could, would we dismiss all the others? And what about the bottom? What about the way that the work changes over time, or the way it's understood changes over time? That if there was some original meaning in the author's mind, then all of the changes that come to the meaning of a work over time can't be true. Because there's only one meaning, and it's there.
Nothing exists like that, like final, complete. Everything, life carries on, so everything.
Well, I'm bound to say in response to that that an equilateral triangle is the same for Pythagoras as it is for me. There are a special class of concepts,
yes,
which we would say almost that's what defines them as mathematical.
Yeah.
Is that they do not change. So we've got it.
That's math.
Yeah, that is math. And I'm saying, and that it's almost what defines mathematics is you've got something so absolutely unambiguously defined that it's outside of time. So it's when I refer to the Pythagoras' theorem, it's the same theorem that Pythagoras created, but it's kind of dead. It's not like a Lawrence novel.
No.
You know, it's the same, but that means it doesn't live either. It's
it has a different purpose from a novel,
yes,
isn't it? The meaning, it's a completely different kind of meaning.
But there was, I mean, the philosophers of language, especially the logical positivists and the people in the mid-20th century, really felt that there was a logical structure to language which was mathematical. That essentially, the ambiguity that we have in our language is a defect. That if we had the right language, which is a mathematical language, we could express in absolute detail what the author had in mind. And in fact, shall I tell you how you do that? You do a brain scan. You do a brain scan. You record the behaviour of every last atom and molecule in the brain of the author. This is like materialistic science would say, across the entire episode of them writing the book. And maybe you need to record the brains of everyone else, but that because of the context. But no, that actually you could then, if you like, you could replay the experience that the author was having. Yeah, so there is a kind of an ultimate end. That form of thinking, that's the ultimate end of it, would be, yeah, there's a formal, absolutely formal, precise, unambiguous way of describing what the author's meaning was. It was exactly what was happening in the brain of the author.
It doesn't work like that, because he'll be thinking about his cup of tea and all kind of other things.
No, that's in the recording.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, so that's part of the meaning, but it's not, because he's creating something outside of himself. He's not creating a picture of inside his head. He's creating a separate thing.
Yeah, no, I think, because I am the mad scientist, you know, with the brain in the vat. You're basically, in that world, it's a mad scientist world. Your consciousness is projected into that brain, and you just experience the author writing the book.
Well, that'd be a very uncomfortable experience.
Wouldn't it? Yeah. Well, it wouldn't. If you could actually do that, it would be. I'm sorry to know so much philosophy. It's like Swamp Man.
It's different, though, isn't it? Because it's not the experience of writing the book. It's the experience of the book, which is.
I'm making this up as I go along. No, because if you try to extract the book out of that brain recording, you'd have lost all the context that you're saying. The cup of tea, what I read in the newspaper today, you know, the fact that I've just had an argument with my son, you know, all of that would have been the context of the writing. Without that, you don't really have the full meaning, do you?
But also, I mean, this transfer of meaning is more like when you throw a ball to somebody, you throw the ball, they catch the ball. So it is the action, like what he says, isn't it? It's about the throwing and the catching. You cannot throw without somebody catching, and you cannot catch without somebody throwing.
But what you're throwing isn't the meaning. You're throwing a bunch of symbols on a page, aren't you?
Yeah, but you're going to
project.
But you're deliberately choosing to leave stuff out.
I think similar to DNA, in that DNA has to be expressed and you get natural variation, and that's the best you can have. Is that we can all share the same DNA, but given our lives are slightly different, we have variations in ourselves, and that comes from variations in interpretation of the text, so that our DNA is being expressed and interpreted in different ways, and project onto that.
Yes, but at the moment, because that's getting towards where Bortov's going. At the moment, we're trying to appreciate the problems of this idea that meaning is somehow has a kind of I mean, I think I bumped into it then, that it has some kind of timeless existence, like the existence of the equilateral triangle, because behind this position that he's criticizing, it is a sort of a mathematical understanding that when you write anything, there is some kind of objective, fixed, timeless thing that is the meaning, and that it has an existence that's independent of everyone's experience later of what they go through when they read it, except, and the idea being, that there's somebody who's really, really diligent could finally get, somebody who's absolutely clear, maybe has done the going back into the past and understanding the context and everything, somebody who does absolutely all the research, knows everything about the author, everything about the situation, and has the brain scan. Let's say you don't actually have to go through it, but you can read the brain scan, you know every last detail about the circumstances of the writing. You finally think, oh, I finally got it. That's it. I understand the meaning of the text. there's a kind of an idea there that, that's what's required, and that was an idea in the ancient hermeneutics, that you got to know everything around about the context. You got to know the text in all of its detail, and finally, through absolutely diligent study, you might just be able to get back to what the author meant. But you see, there's always the scepticism. How could you possibly know?
Is it a pure consciousness you're going to behind there? Is that what the meaning is?
No, I haven't. I have to say, after reading this, I'm not sure what I think, which is a good place to be. I'm not sure that I fully agree with. I'm inclined towards this timeless form of a work myself. I'm not altogether against this kind of idea, but we won't get there yet.
What's going to mind for me is when I was studying Measure for Measure for over a long time. And reading Shakespeare and hardly understanding, you know, the words and finding it difficult. And then getting to a point where it was just a line and it was measure for measure. And I understood the whole play is every line is about measure, you know. So it was like, it just caught me. And so to me, that's again, I have to stay with this because I keep coming back to this thing about the form that's almost like an entity, you know, that it's there, and but it shapeshifts, you know, for different eras or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there, and, you know, I mean, Shakespeare, he entitled it Measure for Measure, so I'm thinking he might have had, you know. But to be able to, as an artist, you know, to be able to create measure for measure in words was just amazing to me. It was like not just that line, but suddenly I realized this whole play is about measure for measure.
Yeah, no, you're pointing something out there that's quite often in a great work of art. There's some kind of, often like a moment, I think, where the whoever wrote it saw it all at once.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, like, and I think you've got that for Measure for Measure, like everything in the whole play, everything in the whole play was informed by this one idea, and when you hit the play at the bottom, you just got this big string of words. Yes, and in a way you do have to get back to the was a unifying ideas. Maybe the wrong, it's too simplistic, but there was a unified vision behind it, where all of the parts are in proportion somehow. Do you know they? You can see there's a form there, which has a certain kind of it's hard to put it, isn't it? Balance, but balance is a too weak a word. You have it in certain paintings, works of art. You can't just put it into words. You just know that you couldn't change a dab on that canvas, that every single bit of it is connected to every single other bit in a certain way, that it's a unity, and you get the sense of the unity in all of the diversity of it, and you sort of know that you're in touch with something, that the creator was in touch with, you can't explain.
It's like the feeling of things, isn't it? The feeling.
But it's actually something actually happens, right? Like you say, there's a moment where it comes together, and you can't. It's like the joke. You couldn't possibly explain it.
Mm.
You just know that there's a unity there, that's got a kind of a. Something transcendental to it.
Mm.
It's a unity that's beyond. I mean, people try and get a ruler out. I mean, the golden section. I mean, there is. I mean, in you know, medieval art, they did have a mathematical form that they tried to follow, but that wasn't the smile of the Mona Lisa, right? It's there's something else going on there that's quite extraordinary, isn't there? When you and you you don't only certain works of art communicate it to one.
Mm. Good portraits are the best. Good portraits from really long ago, and you can see that's a person. That's a, that, it's just amazing. The portrait gallery got some really good old portraits, and you're looking and you can really see that's them. In all their old clothes and things, and that understanding, that immediacy of people from the past, again, of suddenly understanding that person was really there and wasn't just an image, the kind of image of maybe badly painted people, not badly painted, but stylized people from an era when you see, you can just, the flash of someone's personality in a portrait.
So perhaps there are modern artists that have thought about this, haven't they? In terms of putting this together, I presume, in terms of, but going on from this idea, a sense of diversity in all the segments. So I've got a picture that was given to me by someone that, by an old university friend, and I think it was Matisse. Matisse the Snail, is that right?
Yeah.
The what?
It was a Matisse.
Yeah,
Matisse.
Yeah, it is Matisse, is a cutout, there's mother's cutouts.
And then it just it makes the figure of a snail, but there all segments do balance themselves out. So it does. There are certain people that have captured this. You're right, and that's just, I mean, I haven't sort of necessarily gone to the National Portrait Gallery and seen it with my own eye, but with that one. Into focus for me.
That doesn't make a lot of sense because you've got Matisse there with just blue card, I think, isn't it? And some shears cut in, put back onto a board, and you do think, that's it.
A sense of rightness, isn't it? It's something that's right.
But if you can't, if you were to explain it, it would disappear.
That's the
thing about it, isn't it?
Or try to do it itself.
That's like some pieces of music I've tried to, learn on the guitar, you can destroy the piece of music by figuring out how to play it, you sort of take it to pieces and then. As soon as you take something to pieces like that and it's all in bits and you put it all back together again, it's kind of lost it's lost the unity that it had before you did that. It's kind of it's dangerous stuff to muck around with. It's like
in terms of even your own personal enjoyment.
Yeah. yes.
Well, that was fantastic.
Yeah.
What I did was great.
Yeah. Leave it as it is. So I'm just going to, because I did a bad thing. It said that I went up there, Wes, and it said, leave it alone. But I didn't. I said it to the right time.
Oh, good.
I thought leave it alone. You couldn't really want to leave it alone. So that is the right time. I'm willing to carry on a bit longer. Everyone else is sort of sitting here. Is that okay? Is that okay with everyone? No emergency. A little pee break.
Yeah, that's the emergency.
Yeah, a little pee break. Oh, there is. Yeah, there is.